This is the Fox News Rundown Extra.
Hi there. It's Dave Anthony. Very glad to have you with us for a little extra from the Fox News Rundown podcast, or in today's case, a lot extra. Earlier this week, I sat down with Republican Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky. He has a new book out, The Case Against Socialism, and we talk about it after discussing some big issues like the fighting in Syria and the Ukraine controversy-turned impeachment inquiry. Now, keep in mind, we talked to him before there was an attempted ceasefire brokered by Vice President Pence in Turkey. Now, for time purposes, in the rundown the other day, we weren't able to put everything from the interview in. Well, today, you get to hear all of it. And as always, thanks for listening. We hope you continue to. And now, Senator Rand Paul on the Fox News Rundown Extra. Joining us now is Republican Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky, who has a new book out, The Case Against Socialism, which we will get to in a few minutes. We want to begin, though, first by welcoming you here. Thank you, Senator, for being here.
Thanks for having me.
So I wanted to get your take on some big things that are still in the news, that particularly the situation in Syria, which has gotten dire in the northern part of that country for the last week as Turkey moves in with an operation to go after Kurdish fighters who are the U.S. allies in the battle against ISIS. When this all started and the president said he wants to pull back U.S. forces from that area as Turkey moves in, a lot of Republicans, a lot of Democrats in Congress were very critical of the president. You supported the move. Why?
You know, I think sometimes we get the timeline a little incorrect on this. The president had a conversation with Turkey where they said they were coming in. Mm-hmm. And so we had 50 soldiers there. And you would think if you were thinking strategically or about the safety of your soldiers, leaving 50 soldiers in front of tens of thousands of Turkish troops wouldn't be a smart thing. And people say, oh, well, if he'd left the 50, they would have stayed. No, they were coming. And in fact, even as they came, we still had some special forces that were seeing bombs dropped around them. That was reported on the news. So I don't think our 50 were a deterrent at all. I do think that we should listen to the president. His stated goals were to defeat ISIS. He did. He never had a stated goal that says, oh, we're going to provide and make an independent homeland for the Kurds in Syria. I think the best chance for the Kurds in Syria actually is probably having a coalition with Assad. Assad did win the war, for better or worse. He's still in power, and I think he will remain. I think there's a possibility that the Kurds could develop an autonomous region where they are, up in the northeast quadrant, the same way the Kurds in Turkey have a semi-autonomous region as well. But you have to talk to Assad. In our country, the people who are all criticizing the president are the same people who say you can't talk to Assad, we need to topple Assad, and that's still the goal, is regime change. Well, regime change hasn't worked real well in the Middle East, and I think that one of the things that we could do is use our leverage as the major supplier of arms in the region to restrict arms to people unless they're willing to come to the table. I would restrict arms to Turkey for a multitude of reasons, but I think we should force them to the table. But the table's got to include Assad, and that's been part of the problem. We weren't willing to include Assad. Assad has to be at the table. Frankly, probably the Russians and others have to be at the table.
It's kind of a messy group of people to talk to, right?
Exactly.
I mean, we have Putin and that whole 2016 election and 2020 election hanging over our heads, Assad and the red line in the Obama years still hanging around. But the president was so strongly criticized. One of your colleagues, Republican, of course, Senator Lindsey Graham, said it was the biggest mistake of his presidency. And Senator Graham is leading now the call and the push for sanctions. He says he's working with the president on these. Would you sign off on those sanctions?
Well, I think we need to remember that Senator Graham's been wrong about a lot of things. He was wrong about the Iraqi war. He and the Cheneys said we'd be greeted as liberators, it'd be a cakewalk, and, you know, Thomas Jefferson would get elected and all of that. Turns out we did win the war, and there are some freedoms in Iraq, but Iraq is now aligned with Iran. Their closest ally is Iran. The balance of power has shifted towards Iran because of the defeat of Hussein, who was a counterbalance.
And the Iraqis don't even want us there anymore.
Yeah, but Lindsey Graham was wrong about the Iraq war. He was also wrong about the Libyan war. He said, oh, we topple Gaddafi. You know, he and Bolton said, oh, we'll topple Gaddafi, and then peace will reign, and Thomas Jefferson will get elected. Turned out we had chaos and more terrorism. So first off, I'd say that I would take Lindsey Graham with a grain of salt because he's been wrong on so many things. What I would say about sanctions is that I think we need to use all the leverage we have to get Turkey to behave in a better way. I'm not as much a fan of sanctions as I am withholding arms, because arms go to governments, sanctions are on people. Mm-hmm. And so there's a possibility, and this happens over time, there's a possibility that you drive the people away from you. Same way with the embargo on Castro or the embargo on Iran. We're trying to hurt the government, but in the people not having goods and services, the government says, oh, it's because of America, and then the government becomes stronger because we need to be strong to oppose America.
But if we can't use sanctions as a weapon... Like, we wouldn't cut off sales of military equipment to Iran. We don't do that.
It's a little harder there.
Right, with right. Turkey, so what, with what do you do?
With Turkey, it's a possibility. And since they've been an ally, it makes more sense, I think. I would do the same with Saudi Arabia, too. Frankly, I think Saudi Arabia's behavior has been abominable. Not only the killing of Khashoggi, but also what they've done in Yemen. And I think when Khashoggi was killed, I think it was an opportune time when the Trump administration could have stood up and said, no more arms until something changes. Something's going to have to change. And the main thing is no more blockading of food, preventing food from going into Yemen. And you need to just quit bombing them. You need to have a ceasefire and sit down and talk with the opposing parties. I think we had the power to do it because the Saudis entirely depend on us to fix the planes, fuel the planes, you name it. The Saudis are completely dependent on us. But we don't do that. The arms keep flowing. And I've been part of the coalition's voting to cut off arms. We actually got to a majority vote, but the president vetoed that. But most definitely with Turkey, we should restrict their arms sales.
Don't worry about ISIS resurging because of the battle between the Kurds and the Turks now?
Well, the thing is that the people say, oh, we were so lucky that the Kurds fought for us against ISIS. Well, that is just ridiculous. They fought ISIS because ISIS is in their home camp chopping off heads, and we did help them. But it wasn't sort of like, oh, they were just donating their services to the United States. They fought because they live there. Do you think they're really just going to say, hey, ISIS, remember you chopped off 20 people's head, and that was so great, we're going to let you go? You know, it's ridiculous. It won't be in their self-interest to let these people go.
Although some have left. I mean,
but it also is complicated in that not everybody in those camps is somebody who was chopping heads off. So
there's families there.
Well, it's enormous amount. Some say 10,000, some say 20, 30, some say 90,000. The numbers are mind-boggling, but all of those people aren't necessarily terrorists. They're people that may have been sympathetic. And you know how war is. They round up everybody who sort of looks halfway sympathetic with the other side. And this is a hard part about war. And when we had the most devastating war in our country, it was the Civil War. We still did figure out a way to say, all right, you're taking your horse and your gun, you're going home and start farming. And it wasn't perfect. I mean, Reconstruction was we had a lot of problems still in our country, and probably took 80 or 90 years to work out sort of still the racial tensions, which we're getting close to figuring out. But it's hard. What do you do with 90,000 people? You can't just release all of them. But you can't keep them all either.
Right.
So the people there have to determine that. And that's why people who say, well, America's indispensable and America should determine it. We don't even speak the language. How are we going to figure out who is the really bad from the really good, from the not so bad?
So you're with the president. Let's back away out of this.
Absolutely. It's bankrupting us also. And the thing is that there is a backlash to everything. There is blowback. So one of the areas I agree with the president on Syria, but I'm not so much in agreement on Saudi Arabia. Putting more troops in Saudi Arabia, I think, will excite the crazy jihadists across the world to say that's our real, real holy land there, and we're not going to stand for you as troops there. I think it will incite terrorism across the world.
You reference the Civil War. 3 years after it ended, we had the first impeachment of a sitting president. Andrew Johnson barely survived that one by a couple of votes in the Senate in a trial. Here we have the impeachment inquiry going on now in the House. We're maybe getting close to some sort of a vote. You're in the Senate. You may be sitting there voting at the trial. What do you think?
I think that the only thing that we know for certain is that both political parties seem to have tried to manipulate Ukraine to study or not study corruption. Mm-hmm. And so Biden's the first one. He's bragged about it. He said, you know, they have $1 billion in loans, and if they don't fire some guy, you know, I'll cut off your aid. So Biden did and admits that he threatened their aid.
He says he was following United States policy.
Could be, but he did threaten their aid. And so that's the question. Is it okay to threaten another country's aid? Now, they say, well, the president threatened it for political purposes. Well, Biden, some argue, threatened it for his own son's personal enrichment. His son was making $50,000 a month. And I just laugh when I read the left, all their stories. Every story in actual news stories puts a paragraph in there saying these have all been studied and refuted.
Right. Debunked. And typically, completely, yes. Conspiracy theories debunked.
And it's like, who studied this? Nobody's ever studied this. No prosecutors ever looked at this stuff. But I think when the American people hear it, and this is why the groupthink on television is really trying to cut off. If you mention Hunter Biden made $50,000 a month, They try to cut you off. That's a conspiracy theory. Well, no, he did. He made $50,000 a month. If it was honest, he needs to come forward and say he earned it honestly. He was like, I don't know, 37, 39 years old.
But it's not a crime for him to make $50,000 a month on that board in Ukraine, right?
Well, but it's extraordinarily unusual. I talked to somebody the other day, and they said if you're on a big major corporation in our country, you might get $200,000 to $300,000. And usually, to get on a board of a major company, you have to have some sort of experience. You may have been a CEO of your own company. Mm-hmm. So it's a lot of ex-CEOs and high ranking people, very successful investors, et cetera, get to be on these boards. A 37-year-old kid whose main claim to expertise is that his dad is vice president and has traveled 13 times to Ukraine, it really doesn't pass the smell test. And so, you know, I think they have a hard time because they want to blame the president, blame the president, blame the president. And yet it really looks like something shady was going on with Hunter Biden.
All right, but let's go to, I mean, people on the left will say, see, here you are, the Republicans, trying to take away the argument about impeachment. The president violates his oath of office. You want to talk about Joe Biden. They claim that the president being on the call with Ukraine's president at the time, Zelensky, to say, hey, I want you to look into this, do me a favor. They think and believe that that itself is impeachable offense, whether or not there's a quid pro quo.
But it's not just Joe Biden's threats to him. There were three or four senators, Democrat senators, who wrote to the Ukrainian government, and they said in their letter, if you don't continue to investigate Trump through the Mueller investigation and the Trump collusion ties in Ukraine, we may reconsider our bipartisan support for your aid. Is that appropriate? Trump's their political rival. They're doing the same thing. They're threatening aid to Ukraine if they don't continue investigating their political rival. I think that's exactly the same thing. I think it's like, how can you have two different standards of justice? So these four senators can do that. One of the Democrat senators was there 2 months ago. And when he was there in the Ukraine, he was saying, well, if you do investigate Hunter Biden, it may threaten our bipartisan support for your aid. Everybody's threatening Ukraine, it sounds like. If you're not threatening Ukraine, it's like you're the anomaly if you haven't threatened Ukraine's aid. And I figure I might as well jump in it. I've just said, look, we don't have any money anyway, so why do we give them any aid? We got to borrow it from China to send it to Ukraine. So if I need to get in on threatening Ukraine, I'm there. I just say no more aid.
But the impeachment itself, what if it happens? What if they end up impeaching President Trump and sending it over to the Senate?
I think it fails on purely political party lines. And I think the American people are going to see it after a while. And this is the danger to the Democrats is will the American people perceive it as an overreach of partisanship?
51% in the latest Fox poll. It said they support impeachment and removal.
Yeah, numbers go up and down all the time. And I think the media that dominates this, other than Fox is and a few others, is really dominated by the other side. I mean, one of the networks, I can't remember the name, C something or other, but they had, you know, they've been going on. They've had nonstop sort of their own impeachment inquiry for what, two and a half years, because the Mueller thing was essentially the beginning of their impeachment inquiry. And they really thought they were going to get the smoking gun. Then they finally didn't get it. And so now they thought ahead in this conversation. They all went crazy. And Nancy Pelosi jumped up and down and said, this is it. We've got the smoking gun. And she said she was filing for impeachment before she read the conversation, which to me sounds so vintage Donald Trump that it sounds like an everyday conversation that he has twice a day.
And now they might not even want to have the whistleblower who led this whole thing to show up and testify.
And one of the things that needs to be brought to the attention of everyone is the whistleblower illegally received this information about this phone call. So the president's phone call is listened to by a group of people.
Right.
Even that, I think, is a mistake. But anyway, let's say there's 12 people that are legally authorized to listen to it.
I think Pompeo was on the call.
Yeah, there's a printed transcript, and maybe there's 20 people that are allowed to get it. One of those persons, they're not, the president's phone calls could involve the name of a spy or a hostage or somebody in a foreign country that could be killed if their name came out. Or it could involve the discussion of a name of somebody that's working for us, an agent or whatever. Right. So you can't let anybody leak the president's conversation to a foreign leader. Someone did. And the whistleblower wasn't in the 20 people, is my understanding. The whistleblower is outside of that group. So he received or she received illegal information. The person who leaked that has to be removed from government. There has to be an investigation because the danger is that that person has political reasons for not liking the president and is going to selectively leak things they don't like. And I think really the whistleblower's complaint is a political one. It's not a matter of a law that's been broken. He doesn't like the idea, and it seems unseemly to some people that the president would get involved with investigating a particular person. But I don't know if there's any law or anything else that's been contravened.
All Barr has been a key word in the last year for Democrats in their investigation. That's the word obstruction. They went after him, of course, in the Mueller report. And now with this, with the White House not wanting to cooperate in this inquiry, they're saying that that's also evidence of further obstruction.
Another word for it would just be separation of powers. You know, both the executive branch and the congressional branch have their own set of powers, and they jockey back and forth. And they're supposed to have checks and balances, but part of the checks and balances is resisting. So presidents, since the beginning of time, have resisted anything Congress tries to tell them to do. And so I would say that's a normal jockeying back and forth. And if you say you're going to try to bring a president down, my guess is the president will resist you. And we'll see where it shakes out. But the president's actually been more forthcoming. I mean, if he wanted to, he didn't have to release the whistleblower's complaint, and he didn't have to release the transcript of that phone call. The president's gone, I think, above and beyond the call of duty in being transparent with this.
Senator Paul, you have a new book, The Case Against Socialism. Congratulations on it.
Thank you.
It's a heavy read. There's a lot in here, of course, and there's a lot of very serious issues that are, even in the presidential election now, where we have Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, they're among the leaders in this race, and they are like Democrat socialists. So is that why you wanted this out now?
Yeah, I think the fact that you have prominent people running for president on the Democrat side who admit that they're socialists is extraordinary in our country. We've really never had that. We've had socialists run before, but they would get very small percentages and they'd be in a marginalized
party. One of those third parties, yeah.
Exactly. This is the first time a major party seems to be heading headlong into socialism. And Bernie Sanders is such a leader that they all sort of follow him. And so if he comes up for something, then all of a sudden all the rest of them are for him. So I think that, like, Elizabeth Warren and Bernie Sanders, it's hard to tell a whole lot of difference between them. So my wife and I got the idea. It was like, yeah, we're worried about socialist candidates, but we're also worried about the polls that are showing young people, a majority of young people now have a favorable perception of socialism.
Why is that?
Well, if you do more polling, you ask them what socialism is, you find they don't completely know what socialism is. So maybe that should give us some heartening value.
But is this just fairness? Is that what this is all boiled down to?
Maybe. You know, if you define socialism the way we did traditionally, that it was state ownership of the means of production or ownership of private property, only about 16% of the kids understand it that way. They think more it's fairness and equality and that kind of thing. But what we point out in the book is that if you want equal outcomes, you want everybody to be equal, because we are unequal, it means the law has to treat people in an unequal fashion. And I think this is an irony that the left needs to understand. The left is very proud of being for equal protection. So am I. I'm for equal protection. I don't care who you are, what color your skin is. The law should treat everybody equal. And it took a while for our country to get there, but it's an amazing and incredible principle, equal protection under the law.
And there's LGBTQ now as part of the mix in the Supreme Court coming up, and their rights.
But if you have socialism, what you have is you have equality of outcome, but since people are unequal, what ends up happening is that you have to treat them unequally in order to distribute things equally again. And then the rub of this is that government has to decide how to redistribute things. And what you find in socialism is that you find you still have a top 1%. So in Venezuela, socialism has devastated the production and distribution of food. They have more oil than any other country on the planet, but they have no food now.
People have fled the country.
Yeah. So the average of Venezuelans lost 20 pounds because of socialism. And yet Maduro must be 50, 60 pounds overweight. So he and his generals are well-fed and eating. They are the 1%.
And you pointed out in your book about the moment when he's at some famous celebrity chef restaurant.
Right. And in our country, though, our problem is not a lack of food. It's too much food. We actually have an obesity problem in our country from too much food. So that's the opposite. We have abundance because we have capitalism. When you have socialism and you set the price of things, if you set the price too low, all the food's gone. If you set the price too high, the food rots on the shelves. The only way you can find the market price that supply and demand create is by putting it out there and let people either go to Walmart or Kmart or Kroger. They make their choices and there's a marketplace. But when the government fixes a price, they don't know what the correct price of anything is, and so you get shortages. And we've had it in our country, too. Nixon had wage and price controls. Carter had it on oil.
Gas lines as a kid.
I do. I just turned 16, and we tell the story in there in 1979 of waiting in gas lines. I go, I'd just gotten off my bike and got a car to drive. Now I had to go back on my bike because you couldn't get gas.
We had even odd days. I mean, that was back in the day in the 70s, you know, depending on what your license plate number was, I think it was. Income inequality is a big part of the case for Bernie Sanders and Elizabeth Warren. The rich are getting richer, the poor are being left behind, and the argument is that the rich are getting richer on the backs of the poor.
And this is a big lie. Basically, it's the lie that Bernie perpetuates all of the time, that the economic pie is one size, and if you get rich, I've got to get poor. Someone's got to get poor. Or you can't just get rich without taking it from me. But that assumes that the pie's not growing. But the statistics are incontrovertible. The world's economy has doubled 8 times in the last 200 years. So the economy is growing just massively. All the naysayers, you know, Paul Ehrlich and the people who were predicting the end of the world, population would double and we're going to have famine. Well, it turns out we did incredible things. Like farming's one of the most amazing things in our country. We produce so much. So the population doubled, and we used 12% more land, but we produced 300% more food on the land. So it's just amazing what we're able to do through farming, but that's capitalism. But you go to Venezuela, they don't produce any food. They import all their food. They were just using their oil income. The price of oil went down, and it's just a wasteland now.
Now, as part of this, though, the call is also on businesses. They're not paying enough. They need to pay more in their fair share. So how in the battle of taxing can you deal with this? Because that's part of what they have to say. They need to pay for Medicare for All and all the other things.
This is another one of the big lies of Bernie Sanders. He says that he wants to be like Scandinavia and he wants to be like their socialism. Well, first of all, they don't have socialism. But second of all, they don't have high corporate income taxes. They actually have low corporate income taxes. So for the last 20 to 30 years in Sweden and Denmark, their corporate income taxes have been lower than ours. We had 35%, highest in the world, and they were in the low 20s. Now, recently, Donald Trump and Republicans and no Democrats lowered the corporate rate from 35 down to 20. So we're now equal to Scandinavia for the first time in 3 decades. So he says he wants to be like Scandinavia, except for he really doesn't. The other big lie about Scandinavia is their welfare system. They have a lot of free stuff, so-called free stuff, paid for by the taxpayer. It's really paid for by the working class and the middle class. You know, the left over here says only the rich people are going to pay for it. We'll just tax the heck out of the rich people. Over there, they have a 25% sales tax that is on the backs of the working class. They have a 60% income tax, starts at $60,000. So they really, you know, and this question keeps coming up for Elizabeth Warren and others. Are you going to tax the middle class? And they kind of dance around it. All of their things they're offering, there isn't enough money. You can tax the top 1% 100%, and you don't have enough money for all these crazy programs that the left wants. So the dirty little secret of Bernie and the today socialists is, if you want the stuff they're offering and you vote for it, you're going to have massive taxes on the working class and the middle class.
I know you have to go. Last question, how's your health? You've recovered from quite the ordeal?
Mostly better. I had some major surgery in August to remove part of my lung, had a significant infection back in the hospital, out of the hospital. But, you know, thinking about fighting against socialism just keeps me coming back for more.
The book, The Case Against Socialism, from Republican Senator Rand Paul from Kentucky. Senator, thanks very much for joining us.
Thank you.
You have been listening to the Fox News Rundown. Stay up to date by subscribing to Fox News Radio's hourly newscast at foxnewspodcasts.com. And for up-to-the-minute news, visit foxnews.com.